Probably you notice that the titles or descriptions in each of the topics that we are to discuss are a little bit different. So, although they might be different, we will still deal with the same ideas that are written there, although we may be using different words. So, for this first meeting, we will deal with the main tenets of theosophy. Then in our second meeting, we will deal with the different paradigms or views regarding our universe. Then in our third meeting, we will touch on our human nature. And then in our fourth meeting, we will deal with consciousness and some of the laws that operate in the universe and in our human nature, sometimes known as karma also. And then in the last meeting, we will deal with the spiritual life or the approaches towards spiritual growth. Now, of course, it is very presumptuous to say that in five meetings, we can cover the entire field of theosophy. So what we will do is merely touch on the highlights, beginning with this evening's meeting. The library, I understand, has prepared, they are ready with some suggested books or list of literature that probably you might like to read during these meetings. So if you ask those who are in the library, I'm sure they will be able to suggest some literature or books that you might like to read along the talks that we are having during this short course on theosophy. Tonight we will approach this in three ways. First, we will take an overview of what we call theosophy. Then we will go into the main ideas or main tenets or key ideas of theosophy. And then at the end, we will touch on a little of the whys and wherefores on the study of theosophy and the Theosophical Society, which involves itself with this work we are doing. Now, there is something that has been kept open, that there are some who felt that we might meet for 45 minutes to maybe 50 minutes or less than an hour, and then the remaining hour or less than that, we might break up into, this seems to be a large gathering, so maybe three or four groups, so that each one can have a chance to probably ask questions or articulate some of the ideas that we will be discussing during the meeting. So we kept this open. So maybe after the 45 or 50 minutes, we will pose this question, whether you would like to stay together for maybe question and answers or break down into groups. You may still have the question and answers, but then everyone has a greater chance of articulating some of their own ideas. So we will begin with an overview of theosophy. The word theosophy, in its etymology or origin of the word, simply comes from two Greek words, theos and sophia. So most of us are familiar with this, but for those who are coming across this for the first time, we have two words here, theos, and this is a Greek word. These are Greek root words. Theos simply stands for God or the divine, and sophia stands for wisdom. Now, if we look at the entire field of human endeavor in our search for truth, for God, for reality, or for beauty, you will find that they can be divided into four specific fields. Now, usually, one is not interested in any of these fields. There is a time in one's life when we begin to ask some of the deeper questions about life and our existence and the universe. And then when that time comes, then we become interested in one of these fields of human endeavor that hopefully might provide some of the answers that we ask. Because ordinarily, people are concerned with, you know, making a living, enjoying during the weekends, following a particular religion, and then probably preparing for old age, and then enjoy the things one hasn't enjoyed while one was young. And then they say you kick the bucket, you know, or give up the ghost, and then hopefully maybe there might be a heaven waiting for us. But there are some who would like to go beyond this. They would like to find out for themselves. First the ideas, and then later on, after the theories and conceptions that they have and principles, then they come to the point where they say, I would like to experience this truth for myself. Then when that time comes, we might say, then one is really ready for what we call theosophy or the divine wisdom. And we say, in our search for truth, for God, or reality, there are four fields of human endeavor in which all knowledge available in the world, at least in our planet, at least, there are these four fields in which they can be grouped. And they are, we might say, the field of philosophy, then there is the field of religion, then there is the field of science, and then we might add there is the field of art. Of course, in art we have the search for beauty. What is it that makes things beautiful, or what is beauty? And then in philosophy there is the search for what we might say reality. What is the real and what is the unreal? And then in religion, we might say there is the search for God. And in science, we might say there is the search for truth. But theosophy cannot be confined to simply science, religion, philosophy, or art. It is only in the Western world that we have divisions like this. In the Eastern conception, when philosophy is spoken of, it includes religion, science, and art. But here in our Western views, we divide these fields of human knowledge or these fields of human search for God, reality, or whatever we might call it. Theosophy includes all of this. So in the study of theosophy, one cannot neglect any of these departments or fields of human knowledge. Now, there is one view that theosophy is a synthesis of all the truths that might be found in art, philosophy, religion, and science. But to say that it is a synthesis means that its basis of truth comes or emerges from these fields of human knowledge. The other view is that there is really only one truth, or one reality, or one God, or one beauty. But somehow when the human mind approaches this, then it creates fields of human endeavors like this. Then we start dividing it into these fields of human knowledge. But if there is any one common denominator in these different fields of human knowledge that searches for reality, God, truth, or beauty, we might say that one common denominator would be of the nature of consciousness. The underlying fundamental reality, God, truth behind all of this is consciousness. If you take away consciousness, there can be no truth, there can be no God, there can be no reality, there can be no beauty. It seems that consciousness underlies all of this. Now, to say that without consciousness there can be no God, we do not mean that consciousness is superior to God. This is simply what we mean. God as a concept, as an idea, can be denied. In fact, people who deny God are called atheists, and some of them are quite successful, even approaching it from a very logical way, and they can be even very convincing. But even an atheist cannot deny consciousness. So if we might say, if we are dealing with an atheist, tell this atheist that maybe God is of the nature of consciousness, and if he agrees, then God becomes undeniable, because consciousness cannot be denied. No one can say, although someone can say, I don't believe in God, there's no God. No one can say, I don't believe in consciousness, or there is no consciousness. Because finally, the denial of consciousness is in itself its own affirmation, because one would at least have first to be conscious to be able to deny consciousness. So we can know a lot of things in science, a lot of things in religion and philosophy and art, but most likely if we do not understand the consciousness that is engaged in science, religion, philosophy and art, we probably do not truly understand whatever field it is completely. Let's take just one simple example. Maybe we'll take just science. In science, it is said that as of late, they said, as they look at the forces that are behind the universe, they have found that they can be reduced to simply four forces or fields of forces. And they are. They call this the strong forces. And you know, this knowledge comes from our very good neighbor here, where atomic research is being done. And according to them, there are these strong forces that hold the nucleus of the atom together. And then they say there are weak forces that hold the electrons and the other subatomic particles around the nucleus. Then they also say that there are gravitational forces. And then there are, they say, also electromagnetic forces. So they find that there are four fields of forces. Now they are looking for that one field or one force that unites all of this, and they cannot find it. Now we like to suggest that probably that one field or force that unites all these four forces is of the nature of consciousness. So finally, electromagnetic force, gravitational forces, strong nuclear forces, weak nuclear forces are finally probably expressions of the one force which is of the nature of consciousness. And in theosophy, we are concerned with this consciousness. And deep within this consciousness, we say, is that which we call the divine wisdom that is resident in each one of us. Now, if we look at, let's say, science, very briefly and quickly, we might say they can fall along the following fields. You have the physical sciences, like physics, chemistry. Then we have the biological sciences. Then we have the what we might call psychological sciences. If you like, we can probably include sociological sciences. Like, for example, economics would fall, let us say, under this. And then maybe we can add one more, maybe the mathematical sciences. That is why in the study of theosophy, we draw from all of these resources, but really, we are merely trying to express the one universal consciousness that is of the nature of the divine wisdom, that merely expresses itself, let us say, in the field of science that searches for truth. In religion, we might say, there is the search for God, and so they speak about maybe a being that is the ground of the entire universe, that is the ground of reality of the entire universe, and they simply call it God. And according to them, whatever religion it is, they can fall under these main ideas. All religions say God exists. All religions say that once we were one with Him, and then we got separated. Then we have now the idea of creation. We got separated from Him. Then it says that we can reunite back with Him. And reuniting back with Him, all religions say there is a path. So there is the idea of the path and the idea of reunion. Now, of course, we call this the essentials of a religion. But there are some unessentials, although unessential, we do not say they are not important. By the unessentials, this is what we mean. Customs, traditions, rituals, ceremonies would fall under the unessentials, but essentially, this is what constitutes religion. The existence of God, and then creation took place in the sense that in this creation we got separated from Him, and then we can reunite again with Him through a path. The moment any one of this is missing, it cannot be considered religion. In the field of philosophy, we might say, we can divide this maybe into the study of cosmology, that studies the cosmos. And then there is that branch of what they call ontology, that looks into the nature of things, matter, spirit, that looks into nature itself or the nature of nature. Then there is the field of what they call metaphysics. And there is, of course, the philosophy of art, which is called aesthetics. Under this is included the study of ethics. In art, this will be too sweeping a statement to make. We might say all art can fall maybe under these following activities. We might say painting. We will include printing, so that even the computers now are also included here. And then we have sculpture. Sculpture. And then we have music. Then we have the dance. If you feel there are any others, then we can include it. So all art falls under any of these main activities, all philosophy under this. Here there is the search for beauty. Maybe the greatest art itself is the art of life, rather than the art of the dance, the music, the art of life itself. But the moment we go into the art of life itself, we are dealing with consciousness. Philosophy is the search for reality. We would like to know what the universe is made of, cosmology, what is its nature, ontology, and how it operates and its processes, metaphysics. And then the beauty and order behind this, aesthetics, and probably there is ethics here, the things that are good or bad, right and wrong. Here is under ethics, but just the same, whatever understanding we have here will finally depend on the consciousness that experiences this reality, which we search for it in philosophy. Similarly with religion. Any conception we have about God is of the nature of our own consciousness. We may have theories that we were probably once one with Him and got separated from Him, bring about our creation and the universe in which we live in, and that we can reunite back with Him through a path. Just the same, we are dealing here with our own consciousness also. Likewise, in science, in the search for truth, consciousness is involved. The study of physics, chemistry, are all based, in fact, all science is based on observation. And that observation is concerned, again, with consciousness. The only thing about science in relation to consciousness is that it is so much, very much grounded in sensation. And by sensation, we mean the five senses. In other words, if we don't see, we don't taste, we don't smell, we don't feel, then probably it cannot be real. And so observation and the senses that are the basis of observation generating sensations becomes the criteria of truth in science. If you don't see it, you don't smell it, you don't feel it, it probably cannot be true. But that is understandable because the scientific method is based primarily on observation in one of its steps. Now we will say that consciousness, when we speak about consciousness, we might say consciousness expresses itself in terms of life. Let's put it here, life and form. So this consciousness expresses itself in life and form. And if you look at form, form cannot exist unless we have the conception of space and of time. So if you say this blackboard is a form where there is a space and dimension here, then it exists as of this time, 5 minutes to 8. If we take away the time and take away the space, then it cannot be here. Now all forms, we might say, may be grouped according to these four areas. There is what is called in theosophy the pre-mineral forms. So we will just put here pre-mineral. forms that exist before they manifest in the mineral kingdom. Then there are forms that we might call that are pre-human. So the mineral, the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom will be considered pre-human. So we have now the pre-human forms. Then we have the human. Then we will add one more here that we might call the superhuman. By superhuman, we mean they transcend our humanity. We can even call this maybe the post-human. If this is the pre-human, this is the human, then this would be probably the post-human. All forms will fall under this grouping. Then if you look at life, life is constituted of birth and death. So, the opposite of death is not life, and the opposite of life is not death. Rather, the opposite of death is not life, but the opposite of death is birth. And the opposite of birth is death. And birth and death occur in life. So the unity of birth and death is found in life. So life goes on, but this life may get born and may die, and get born and may die. So life goes on. If you look at life, particularly now, human life, we're concerned now with human life. All our activities in human life may be grouped according to these four. Work, so the life we live at work. And then the life we live here at home and study, like now, this is the life that we live, and then leisure. All our activities in life, particularly human life, can be grouped according to this form. At where, either at work, at study, at home, or at leisure. And this is the life that we live. It is life and form that constitutes consciousness. Or without consciousness, there can be no form and there can be no life. And we say this consciousness finally is of the nature of the divine wisdom, which is resident in every human being. Now we might call this an overview of theosophy. So, theosophy deals with consciousness, with life, with form. It deals with art, philosophy, science, religion. And in life, it deals with birth and death, and the life we live at work, at study, at home, and at leisure. And when it deals with form, it deals with space and time, not necessarily only three-dimensional space and fourth-dimensional time. It can be multidimensional, and it deals with all forms. Not only the human, but the superhuman, the pre-human, and even the pre-mineral forms that it is said comes about to bring about our manifested universe. This is the entire scope or overview or field of what we might say of the study of theosophy. Almost nothing is included. Now, if there are no questions, we will go. Maybe you might like to ask questions. We will go now to the tenets. We can use the back here. Are there some questions you'd like to ask? Yes, please. Yes, by ground is largely a metaphor. Like when we look at the plants, it comes out from the ground. So it is the source. So when we use the word ground, we mean the source, the origin, the beginning, and where it came from, and where it will probably go back. That is the idea of the word ground. And so when we speak of the divine wisdom or theosophy, maybe it is the ground of all of that down below. This could have been drawn, this chart could have been drawn in a reverse order, and it will look like a tree. But the way it is drawn here is like a company organization chart. I used to work with a company, I got used to it, and it's kind of easier. But we don't intend to put ourselves on top and the rest of them are down below. Because the best way probably to draw an organization chart is to put the company president down below. Yeah, because I recall one time having drawn such a chart. You know, then there was the president, and above this was the chairman of the board. Then I left a big blank up the organization chart above. And we were discussing, and then I didn't say anything. And finally, all the executives said, what's this blank one here on top? So I wrote it down, customers. So the customer is above the chairman of the board and the president. And in a way, in theosophy, we are the customers. I don't say this is a business, but in itself, we say, finally, any theosophy that we understand goes back to the ground of our own being, which is our own consciousness. And we might even say the ground of our being and the consciousness that is within us participates in all other forms of consciousness, that is the ground of being of all other forms and life in the universe. Are there some other questions you like to ask? Is consciousness the
first manifestation into the physical
God? I'm hesitant to say yes or no, because a question like this, you know, it cannot be answered by yes and no. What we are doing here is we are just creating concepts. And one of the concepts we are using is consciousness. And we will explore this, I think, in the fourth meeting. But usually the problem is how we define consciousness and what we mean by it. So we will just touch on it quickly. Consciousness, probably the best definition of consciousness to say whether it is the beginning or not, the source or not, probably could be based on this definition. And the best definition, we might say, is a functional definition. So a functional definition is this. Let's say water. If we define what water is, maybe a chemist would say, well, it's made up of hydrogen and made up of oxygen, and there are two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen. And hydrogen is a gas, and oxygen is a gas. If you put these two gases together, you don't get a gas, you get a liquid. Of course, if we are not chemists, we say, how come? How can two gases produce a liquid? A liquid should come from a liquid. Now, this is the definition. The functional definition of water does not say anything. We get a glass of water, and the person says, what's water? We give that glass of water, and we say, drink this. And when he drinks it and swallows it, after that, we say, that's water. That's the functional definition, all right? So likewise, we will use this functional approach in defining consciousness. So if the question is, what is consciousness? Define consciousness. So we will say, are you conscious of this blackboard? Say, yes, whatever that is taking place, that's consciousness. That is the functional definition. Now if you say, I'm not conscious, I don't see anything there, then what do you see? Whatever it is one sees or is aware of, then we say that is consciousness. That is the functional approach. Well, we will go now to some of the main ideas or main tenets. First, there is the idea of what we might call the idea of absoluticity. There is no such word in the English language, so we are just inventing this. That this ground of being, this ground of reality from which everything comes from and everything goes back, is of the nature of the absolute. And the absolute is nonverbal. It is verbal and nonverbal. So it transcends the human mind, it transcends conception, it transcends definition. In fact, the best is the way it has been described in poetry. It is that fundamental reality which veil after veil one will lift, but there must be veil after veil behind. So this is the principle of absoluticity. There is an absolute, the absolute truth, the absolute ultimate reality. Then there is the idea of polarity. Polarity is found in the entire universe. In fact, for anything that we see, there is an opposite of it, and it arises out of the nature of the universe itself. So out of this absolute nature comes, we might say, some kind of state of polarity which pervades all of nature. So even in ideas, for every thesis, there is an antithesis. You recall this? So for every thesis, thesis sub one, there is an antithesis sub one. But every thesis and antithesis has a synthesis, sub one. But a synthesis is in a way a kind of thesis. So this is now our second thesis. Every synthesis is some kind of thesis. But since every thesis has an antithesis, and this thesis now is sub two, so its antithesis would be antithesis sub two. And of course, if we synthesize this symbolically, this would be synthesis sub two of thesis and antithesis sub two. But every synthesis sub two is a kind of thesis, different from this and different from this. So we have now thesis sub three, and it goes on and on. And that is the nature of polarity, even in our human mind. Right. So from this polarity, we might say, emerges all potencies that we see in the universe. So one principle or idea in theosophy is that in everything that we see, it has the potency of everything or every other thing in the universe. Anything that we see in the universe has the potency of every other thing in the universe. And then the theosophy also has the idea of what they call the macrocosm. The large universe of theosophy deals with the largest of the universe that the human mind can conceive of, and it deals with the minutest and the smallest that we can conceive of, and we call this the microcosm. So this potency and this polarity and absolutism is found in the microcosm, from the smallest of the smallest to the largest of the largest, which now is the macrocosm. Then there is the idea of evolution, that this macrocosm is evolving. So the idea of evolution. Now, first of all, maybe we might differentiate evolution as a fact in nature and the theories of evolution. So you have come across some groups, you know, they go around and then they talk like this. They say, no, evolution is against Christianity. You know, we didn't come from the monkeys and all that. Usually the idea of evolution is associated with the Darwin theory of evolution. Now, evolution is a fact in nature, but there are many theories attempting to explain the fact of evolution. And one of the theories attempting to explain the fact of evolution is the Darwinian theory. And there are many other theories. The theory of debris, and then the paraphysicalistic theory, and so on. There are many other theories. But evolution is a fact in nature, and there are many theories attempting to explain this fact. Another example, let's take this one in science. In physics, gravity is a fact in nature, you know, things fall. But there are many theories that try to explain the fact bodies that are falling. So one of them is the Newtonian theory, that there is some kind of electromagnetism that draws things to fall to the earth. The earth is an electromagnet. But of course, Einstein came along and he says there is a better explanation. He says it is because of the curvature of space, rather than electromagnetism. So we have the Einsteinian theory of gravity and the Newtonian theory of gravity. These are different theories, but the fact of gravity is another thing. So likewise, evolution is a fact in nature, but there are many theories attempting to explain this fact. And then there is the idea of involution. In theosophy, we simply call it this way, that there is a movement in the universe where spirit involves itself into matter, and we call this involution. And there is another movement where matter evolves itself from matter into spirit, and we call this evolution. And the two take place together. But this evolution and involution, it is said, takes place in a kind of order. It is not a disorderly thing. So one main idea of theosophy is that there is order in the universe. No matter how we see disorder and chaos, behind this is some kind of order. We only call it disorder because we have not discovered the higher order in which this disorder takes place. Then we say there is also the idea of hierarchy. In a way, the two go together, hierarchy. That in this involution of spirit into matter, there is a hierarchy. And this hierarchy includes this microcosm to the macrocosm. There is a hierarchy here. From the smallest to the smallest of the small to the greatest of the great, there is a hierarchy here. In this involutionary process, there also is a hierarchy. Likewise, there is a hierarchy in the evolutionary process, and this expresses it in a kind of order. In a way, hierarchy implies order, and where there is order, there is some kind of hierarchy. Then we might say this order here now expresses itself through, we might call this periodicity. And here we have the idea of cyclicity. They are the same. That this involution, this microcosm, this order, this evolution, this macrocosm manifests itself periodically. There's a kind of cyclicity behind this. There are other conceptions that go with this. Lately, they have been talking about rhythmicity. That this periodicity is some kind of rhythm, but they are the same. And then this cyclicity that takes place is some kind of symmetry that is taking place. But anyway, whatever it is, it deals with the idea of causality. And this is what in theosophy is called the study of karma. Now, earlier, there is the idea that of this causality, that for every cause, there is an effect, and every effect has a cause, but there may be certain things that necessarily may not have a cause, but that they happen because they are simply in synchronicity with each other. That is another idea. They are in rhythmicity with each other. They are periodicity. Somehow there is a interface of the periodicity that occurs. By interface, we mean they somehow begin to coincide. And then the idea of cyclicity and the idea of symmetry. By symmetry, we mean this. Supposing a good example would be in economics. Let's say the Dow Jones average. Some of you might be in investment. So anything that goes up goes down. If you look at this, this one here is a reflection of this. It's a reflection. So this one reflects itself there. And we call this the idea of symmetry. Then, of course, it goes on. Then we say there is a cycle that is taking place. But does this cause, is this effect caused by this? Did this cause, let's say this is one peak here, was this the cause of this effect here? And was this effect as a cause of this effect here? And so on. We say, well, they are merely in symmetry with each other. They may not cause each other directly, they just happen to be in synchronicity with each other. Maybe another example. Let's say you have a watch and I have a watch. And let's say I live in Los Angeles and you live here in Chicago. Let's say the time difference is 3 hours, right? So two hours, all right, 2 hours. Yeah, New York is 3 hours. So let's say we are 8 o'clock here now. In Los Angeles, it would be 6 o'clock. So if it becomes 7 o'clock there, we would be 9 o'clock here. Now, our 9 o'clock here did not cause their 7 o'clock, and their 7 o'clock did not cause our 9 o'clock. It just happens we are synchronized. The cycles that the watch goes, the second and the long hand, somehow coincide with each other. And this is what we mean by synchronicity. And the idea transcends the idea of causality, of direct causation. Then we might say, this periodicity, rhythmicity, synchronicity, the way it takes place, we say, it points out that we are in a universe that is dynamic. So we have the idea of dynamism here. that we do not live in a static universe. It is in a constant change. In fact, one philosopher once said, the only thing that doesn't change is change itself. Because if change were to change, then there would be no change. So change is the only thing that doesn't change. Here, we have the idea of transformation. And we might say, in this dynamism and this transformation, the universe is constantly transforming itself. We ourselves are also transforming. We say, finally, this leads to our own humanity. So we are always transforming ourselves. We live in a universe that is dynamic, that is in constant change. And then a time comes when we would like to understand the universe in which we live in, the cycles, the periods, the symmetries, and the causalities of the universe. So the moment we do that, we are studying now causality, and we are dealing with our unconsciousness here now. And then as we understand this, then we deal now with, we begin to resolve our problems and resolve some of the questions that we ask, and we will call this now the idea of resolution. That whatever polarities there are in the universe, potencies that manifest at these different levels, from the macrocosm to its dynamic state, from the microcosm to its transformative state, it always can be resolved. And when this resolution takes place, and nobody does this except ourselves, and theosophy helps us bring about this resolution, then we enter into what we call the idea of liberation, the idea of freedom or spiritual freedom. In Christianity, they call it the idea of heaven or salvation. We'll put a quote here. And the idea of heaven in our Christianity. Now, in the different religions other than Christianity, they may have other names for this. The idea of moksha, the idea of samadhi, you know, and then the idea of nirvana as found in Buddhism. But they all refer to the idea of some kind of liberation, some kind of freedom, some kind of salvation, and the heaven that we all aspire for, which can take place only when there is some kind of resolution in our consciousness of the causalities that operate in the universe. And we might say these are the main ideas that we have in theosophy. There might be another here. The idea of perfection also has been used often in theosophy. So whether perfection, heaven, salvation, freedom, or liberation, it finally is a result of what we might call the idea of resolution. And the study of theosophy enables us to come to this point of resolution. And in the four meetings that we will deal with, we will explore some of these main ideas, but finally we will go back to our own consciousness, the consciousness that we have in our humanity, and the consciousness that pervades the universe in which our humanity lives, particularly on this planet Earth and in the solar system to which we belong. So maybe now we might open this for a few questions, and then I will direct the question to you whether you'd like to break up into groups or carry on the question and answer. Are there some questions you'd like to ask or clarifications?
Yes.
It is said that down to the smallest, like even the atom, the potency of a universe is also even in an atom. So, in other words, whatever we see in the universe, it has the potency to become any other thing that is there in the universe. So when we study truth, God, reality, whatever we call that, the potency for that realization is within us and within every other thing also in the universe. Because in our study of theosophy, as we go along, we'll find there is this involution and there is this evolution. And all of this movement is intended to bring about this potency into actuality. Thank you. Yeah. Yes? Yes. Yes.
Why is the word perfection?
Yes. I recall someone who, we were talking about the absolute. And you know, this is something that we cannot talk about. So the moment we link anything to that, then we are talking about something that is hard to talk about. And so I had another diagram, but it was not quite like this, a little bit different, but it began with the absolute. And then he said, how can the absolute have parts? You know, and the perfection would be a part of the absolute. So I said, well, very simple. The absolute whole is made up of absolute parts. So the absolute here is made of absolute perfection. So when we relate to the absolute in anything below the absolute here, we are talking of the absolute polarity, absolute microcosm, absolute hierarchy, absolute. So in other words, the absolute, although a word here, really, symbolically or metaphorically, is the blackboard itself. Everything occurs within the absolute. So, if that is so, that veil after veil will live here, there must be veil after veil behind, then we can take our humanity, the dynamism, the order, veil after veil will live, but there must be veil after veil behind. This is a wonderful universe. You know why? If we come to the last veil and there is no more, this will be a boresome existence. Yes, ma'am?
Can you say a few words about the various kingdoms?
Behind there. Yes, we will deal with this when we come to maybe our particular human nature. But we might mention it here, since probably some of you will be already reading books, but some who are already members of the society are familiar with some of these ideas. So the kingdoms of nature, we talked about a pre-mineral kingdom, the movement of spirit into matter. So when we speak of the pre-mineral kingdom, the technical term used in the study of theosophy is what they call the first, second, and third elemental kingdoms. Now I have added two others, what I simply call the monadic essence and the elemental essence. But we will go into that when we come to probably our third or fourth meeting. Then when we speak of the pre-human kingdom, we refer to the mineral, the plant, and the animal kingdom. And then the human kingdom to which we belong. And then we might call the post-human or superhuman kingdom. We deal here with, if you believe in angels or spirits that are not human, then we deal with beings like this. Lately I've found out that there are many people now who are interested in UFOs, you know, UFOs. And I notice if you talk to them, it is almost like a religion to them, you know, like they have very strong beliefs that if you differ a little bit, they almost even get hurt, you know. And they're very defensive about asserting some of their beliefs and ideas, but that's fine. So even in that realm, we might say if there are unidentified flying objects, then there might be also unidentified, whether flying or not, forms of consciousness. I recall one time discussing with someone who was very much involved with this, I said the greatest unidentified flying objects are the thoughts that float in our minds. That is the greatest unidentified flying object. If we can resolve thought and its nature, then we might enter into that state that transcends thought, and therefore the truth that we speak of, reality, God, becomes an experience within our consciousness rather than a conception, a theory, an idea that is merely perturbating there in the realm of thought. Yes. One more? All right. Metaphysics. The question about metaphysics, yeah. In that other side of the board. Yeah, the question is about metaphysics. Well, I think it was Aristotle who brought this about because there was the study of physics. You study physical things. Now, the moment we go beyond physical things, which are theories, conceptions, and ideas, and paradigms, then meta means beyond. So they call this metaphysics, studying things beyond things that are physical, and we call it metaphysics. That is why they have now like parapsychology. It might as well be metapsychology, like para, meaning beyond the ordinary psychology. Yes, please. Pardon?
Karma.
Karma. Yeah, we use the word karma here to refer to this causality. Christianity? Oh, Christianity, the question of Christianity. Well, that would fall under the study of religion, you know, under religion. By the way, karma now is an English word. You know, if you look at the dictionary, it is now an English word. So we can say the Theosophical Society introduced one word in the English language, which is karma. So one time I had my car repaired and I got a big bill, and the mechanic said, "Your car has bad karma." And of course it was a second-hand car, so he said, "Before you buy a second-hand car, you always check its karma first." Yeah. So it is an English word, it's an English word now. Yes. And of course this is the realm of causality. So something went wrong, so something caused it. So there are things that go wrong too in our life, and they may also go right. So there is a realm, the realm of causality also within our consciousness. And we will have, I think, one meeting dealing with this, the laws and the processes, and how one might resolve this in one's own consciousness. I'll come back to you. Yes. Yes. The question is, the question is to compare or differentiate involution and evolution. Very simply, we might say involution is that movement of that which we call spirit involving itself into matter. And evolution is that movement where matter now moves and transforms itself or returns now to its original state of being spirit. So the movement from spirit into matter is what we call involution, and that movement of matter into spirit is called evolution. And we are what we might say on the path of evolution, where we try to transform and resolve our materiality into spirituality, matter moving into spirit. Yes. Yes. That's a good question. Why did spirit involve or evolve in the first place? You know, one time, this same question in a different way was asked in one university in Texas. And this was the philosophy club there. And they had only one professor in philosophy, and he had a PhD in one of these famous universities somewhere in Boston. And he himself asked this question, you know, why should there be this, you know, this evolution, this involution, or this universe that came about? And the answer that I gave was this, that questions of whys and wherefores are not so much the nature of nature as much as the nature of the human mind itself that looks at nature. You follow this? So the whys and wherefores are more of the nature of the mind rather than the nature of nature herself. Now let's give an example to illustrate this. We are largely mental, and so the nature of the mind is it understands and tries to understand in terms of whys, wherefores, reasons, and justifications, and rationalizations, and logic, and all that. Now, the emotion is not like that. It does not rationalize. The emotion just feels. So we might say in an early stage of humanity where they were more emotional than mental, when, for example, it rained or there was thunder and lightning, so they related to the universe in an emotional way. So they said, oh, the gods must be angry. They must be mad, you know, all this thunder and lightning. But now we relate to nature from the mental point of view. We say, well, that is an electrical phenomenon that is taking place there, expansion of gases, and then this is being ignited and all that. So it creates this sound, and then sound does not travel as fast as light, so we see the light first, and this has been caused by evaporation. So we use our reasoning here. So this is the nature of the mind now that looks at the universe. In itself, the universe, probably, in itself, without the mind looking at it, has no purpose, has no meaning, has no significance. It is complete in itself. We cannot add or subtract anything. A good example of this is love in human terms. Because people will say, if the universe has no meaning and no purpose, how can that be? So let's use love. Does love have a meaning and a purpose? Supposing someone tells you, I love you so much, and this is my meaning, and this is my purpose. Why? Because love is complete in itself. It transcends meaning, it transcends purpose. Likewise, if God is love and the universe came from this God that is of the nature of love, it must carry this nature too, and therefore the universe transcends meaning, purpose, whys, wherefores. It simply is. So you recall even in the Bible when God was asked, who art thou? What did he say? I am that I am. Now, in English, the English language, they call this a tautology, but it depends on how we use it. See, if you ask, who art thou? Let's say I were to play God. Anyway, all of us are gods. Who art thou? Then God will answer, I am, that I am, that I am. You get the meaning? So I am, that I am. You cannot point to anything that which I am not also. So that is the meaning of I am, that I am. So in other words, the idea of potency is also there. God's potency is found in every other thing in the universe. So I am, that I am, each of you that is that, I am that too. So it is not a tautology. So I hope that answers your question. I brought this up because when this answer came up, the students there nodded their heads and they understood right away. But this professor, it took me 3 times to explain it. He said, it cannot be. There must be a meaning and there must be a purpose. But you see, one is, after you take a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and then a PhD, your mind is so ingrained that there is meaning, there is purpose, there is reason behind it. I said, the meaning and purpose is in the mind looking at nature. It is not in nature herself. It transcends this meaning and purpose. So we might say it's transrational. It's trans-significant. It transcends that. Meaning to say it transcends the mind. In theosophy, we call this the intuitive perspective, the intuitive realization. That aspect in us called the intuition, which enables us to understand directly without going through any process of reasoning of whys and wherefores. We just know. And we have an experience like this in the life that we live. Love is a good example. We don't say, after all this reasoning and analysis and these logical propositions, I therefore conclude I love you. It's not like that. You just know. A mother knows it loves its child and it knows right away, directly. And this is within our consciousness and we will be dealing with this, I think, in our 4th meeting, especially. Yes. I'll go back to you. Yes. I hope you still remember your question. Yes, if you like, I'm using the word absolute in an absolute way. And like we were saying, the absolute is that ultimate reality it is said that we cannot talk about. So we may try to talk about it, but whatever we say will never exhaust what the nature of this absolute is. So if we say if it is conscious, therefore unconsciousness is not included in it. So within this, all polarities and all potencies are resolved. And we will be caught. Why? Because the nature of the mind is like that. You see? For every thesis, there is an antithesis. So if we say, is the absolute conscious? What is the antithesis of consciousness? Unconsciousness. Or therefore, is the unconscious not included in the conscious? But how can it be conscious and not conscious at the same time? So we will be caught in that. But we can use this as an analogy. If we say the absolute is God and it is both conscious and unconscious, then we say, how can it be conscious and unconscious at the same time? So if we say as a metaphor that the absolute is the blackboard, and we will write the word here consciousness and the word unconsciousness. So consciousness and unconsciousness. How can the absolute be conscious and unconscious at the same time? If we say metaphorically that the blackboard symbolically represents the absolute, then this consciousness and unconsciousness simultaneously occurs in its absolutism, which is the blackboard. And it's right there. So it's the absolute is the blackboard. So that is the most that the human mind can reach. I will come back to you. You had your yes. Well, this potency is found in all of this. It's found in all of this. We say, so that potency of anything is found in every other thing also. From the microcosm, of the smallest, to the greatest of the greatest. All right. Since your hand is up, I forgot who was that here. All right. Yes. In fact, we might put it this way. Can emotion exist without consciousness or without mind? So the fundamental reality, we might say, is consciousness. But when it expresses itself, let's say in our human form, then it can express itself as emotion, it can express itself as thought, it can also express itself as sensation, and so on. Yes. 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 If it's all right with you, I don't mean to escape from it, but we will be dealing with thought, with emotion, and then sensation in our fourth meeting. And I do not know if you'll still remember your question. Now we will really go into this. But we can state this, that an emotion is a thought insofar really as an emotion, as that emotion is a recycled thought. So, when thought repeats itself, then we have now an emotion. So, here's some of you have gone together with me on this in a more lengthy way. Let's say I have a cake here. This is almost a classic example. If I bite this cake, then I have a sensation, right, of this cake. Then a thought now is created. Oh, this cake tastes good, you know, and so on. So what happens now? The thought says, well, it tastes good. I'd like another bite. So it makes a second bite. So which is biting now? We are doing the biting, but really it is the thought that is really biting. It wants to taste it again and experience it again. So at the moment thought now repeats the cycle of going into the sensation, then we have the occasion for an emotion to arise. Why? If you take out the cake, then you say, hey, where's my cake? If you get it, oh, I'm so happy, an emotion. So when thought repeats itself, we have the occasion for an emotion to arise. And this is the cycle. Huh? Now pursuing a sensation, and when it does so, it generates an emotion. The suggestion is, rather than to intellectualize it, is to carry the idea in the experience that we live in life. So when we have a sensation, watch it. When a thought arises, watch it. When an emotion arises, watch it. And see the process rather than the contents that are involved. So there are many contents in our sensations, many contents in our thoughts, many contents in our emotions, but see the process in the way they relate to each other. And then the seeing of this process and the experiencing of this process is the truth within us that transcends words, philosophies, ideas, theses, antitheses. It is an experience within one's own consciousness. And the moment one really truly understands the processes of one's own consciousness, this process is the same process that takes place in every other consciousness that is human at least. But the contents that go through the process of consciousness may be different. They may differ. But the process is the same. So an analogy for this is, the process of digestion is the same for every other human being, but the contents that go through the digestive process, which are American food, Italian food, junk food, Chinese food, these are the contents that go through the digestive process, may be different. But whatever foods or contents we take in, they go through the same digestive process. So if a doctor understands the digestive process of one human being, it would understand the processes of digestion of all human beings because the process is one. So likewise, In the process of consciousness, of sensation generating thought, and thought now experiencing now sensation producing emotion, and in the cycle recycling all over again, the process is the same for all other human beings. To the extent that one sees this as it takes place and fully understands it in one's own consciousness, to that extent do we understand all other forms of consciousness that are human, at least, because they go through the same process. So we'll take one question. Perhaps maybe some of you, I know you'd like to discuss maybe like this and then get a chance to maybe articulate. So there was one hand here, I hope. On this side, were you the one raising it or you're scratching your nose? Yeah, that's one view. Another view is that they travel probably in spirals. But because we do not see the other dimension, we think they go in circles. Yeah, you know, it goes like that. Yeah, yes, yes. 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 Yes.
If you look on the heaven and underneath it, you have perfection. Aren't you repeating yourself there?
Oh, yes, we are repeating ourselves. Yeah, yes. We are repeating ourselves. These are just words. Yes, we are. These are different conceptions. So, there is the idea of liberation, the idea of freedom, the idea of salvation and heaven. You know, this is the idea in Christianity. Particularly, then the idea of perfection, the idea of nirvana, the idea of the void, you know, and these are different conceptions in religion. So we are repeating ourselves here. That's correct. Pardon? Oh, yes, we can here split this if we like. For every thesis, there is an antithesis. Remember? Yes. So I'm glad you're bringing this up because this is actually a demonstration of the nature more of the mind. Mind is like that. It can split and split and split. Look at science, which is largely a mental approach. The first science was astronomy. Some say it was astrology. So they wanted to study the entire universe. No. And then finally they realized, oh, this is too much. So it broke down, you know. So we'll study only the Earth. The Earth. And then they say, oh, geology. Oh, then there is chemistry. And then it finally breaks down. So now there are not only atomic physicists, there are subatomic physicists. Also now. So like in medicine, you know, first there was the doctor, general practitioner, then there is one who specializes in the head and on the stomach and all that. Then the left foot, the right foot maybe. Then the left eye and the right eye. And that's the nature of the mind. It divides and divides and divides. And we can take almost any topic of study and the mind will divide and divide. So the understanding, it seems, is not so much in the ability to divide and point out distinctions. While we do this, maybe the other dimension is to see how all these diversities come into some kind of unity. So for every thesis and antithesis that we have, for every thought that that might have an opposite thought, the approach would be to look at a higher thought that would reunite these two thoughts that differ from each other. So we can go down the line, dividing, but let us not forget to go up also and unite it. I think, do you like to break up into groups so that you can have a chance to maybe articulate? Maybe there are some who are shy in bringing up questions. Or would you rather continue this as a question and answer this way?
What would you like to
I thought we had a question and answer, then probably then you might like to break into groups. There are some who may not. Too late?
By the time we got them organized,
it would be about 9 o'clock. All right. Does everyone feel this way too? All right. So we will do this next time. Is it all right? Because by then you might have read something already. There are some who want to, you know, express themselves and articulate and clarify certain things. And there are some here who will be helping me in the groups, and I'll be moving from group to group also. Yes. Yeah, please do. So we have more time for questions now. Yeah.
Unity is synthesis, and that would fall into the resolution category?
Yes, yes. Resolution. That's the Trinity. Involution, evolution, resolution. But there is a pun there. They say these are all convolutions, you know, of the brain. Until a time comes when you say, well, I want to transcend the brain. Then we are now into meditation. We stop the brain. We stop the brain, we stop the mind. The mind-brain must stop. Then we go beyond that. Meanwhile, since we are at this level, we go into it as deeply as we can. Yes. The moment one goes beyond the mind, beyond the brain, then they say this is the flight of the alone with a small a to the alone, capital A, capital L, capital O, capital N, capital E. The flight of the small alone to the great alone. This is the real one-to-one. O-N-E, small letters. O-N-E, big letters. The one to the one. Yes, sir? How do you define mind? I remember in philosophy, they were trying to distinguish between mind and matter. You recall that? Yeah. And so they said, what is mind? What is matter? So they said, well, as far as matter is concerned, as far as mind is concerned, it does not matter. As far as matter is concerned, never mind. Never mind. But mind really is an abstraction. So in philosophy, sometimes the idea of mind is used to refer to spirit as opposed to matter. So when it is something that is not of the nature of matter, that is physical matter, so they refer to it as mind in philosophy. This is one way they use it. So when they refer in philosophy to mind, it may not necessarily be something of an intellectual quality. It simply means that it is non-physical. That is one view in philosophy. Another is from the point of view of our own consciousness. We were talking about the process of sensation generating thought and the thought pursuing a sensation, and in its pursuit, it generates an emotion. Now, in this process, in this cycle, there is a point where as we go through this cycle, we start accumulating a lot of thoughts in our consciousness. The accumulation of all these thoughts in our consciousness, in one view, is what we may call mind. So when you say, according to my mind, what we mean here, according to all the thoughts that I have accumulated in my consciousness. So the entire accumulation of thoughts in my consciousness, in one view, is what we may call mind. So here are two views. One, it is a non-material view. One is it is the entire collection of thoughts that we have in our consciousness. By the way, the nature of this collection is that after it collects, the tragedy or not, depends on how you look at it, all these accumulations of thoughts in our consciousness that we call now mind begins to assume now a self of its own. And then we get identified with this accumulation. And then in identity with this accumulation, we say, well, this is my mind. My mind is different from your mind. Why? Because somebody else's collection of thought is different from our collection. And so we say, well, we do not have a meeting of the minds. Now, what do we mean when there is no meeting of the minds? Here is one collection, which we call now mind, another collection, which we call mind, and they do not have the same collections, and they now confront with each other, and they say, now we have no meeting of the minds. But in those areas of thought where they have the same collection, then they will say, well, our minds now meet. In other words, they have collected the same thoughts. That's why people who belong to different cultures, different traditions, different beliefs, different religions, different scientific orientations, it is difficult to have a meeting of the minds because the thoughts they collect, whether in philosophy, science, or religion, are different. So it becomes difficult for them to relate. But if one is able to transcend the contents, which are the thoughts, and understands the process without getting caught in the contents, then here you have truly a meeting of the minds that transcends even the mind itself. You can put it that way also. Then they call this maybe the supermind. In fact, Aurobindo called it the supermind. Yes. They're just words. until finally we experience it within ourselves. And the mind is like that. It can create propositions and ideas until a time comes when we say, I'm not satisfied with conceptions and ideas. I would like to experience this for myself. Then the moment we do that, then we say, well, how can I understand this mind? I can only understand it by going into it and then transcending it. It's like the fish. You know, the fish is looking for the ocean, and it would like to understand the ocean. How can a fish ever find the ocean? The only way a fish can find the ocean is to get out of the ocean. And it, let's say a flying fish, it flies up and says, oh, this is the ocean. But the moment it's in the ocean, where is the ocean? And anyway, we are like that. So there is a universal consciousness in which, like fishes, we are in there. That was the age of Pisces. So we become fishers of men. So we transcend this, and when we transcend it and go beyond this, then we see the world of matter. And then we begin to realize for ourselves we are something more than this consciousness that is immersed in this ocean of materiality. And this is the beauty about this study of theosophy, that maybe this might be a statement that probably some might find maybe a little different from what has been expressed before, and this is largely my view, that in the study of theosophy, there are no beliefs. What we have are simply ideas, like these are some main or key ideas, but in the theosophical society, we leave it to each person to make a belief out of that idea or not. So long as we do not impose our own beliefs or our own ideas on another. So, in a class like this, in a study like this, what we are doing is merely trying to offer as many ideas as there are regarding the universe, about spirituality, and about our consciousness. And we leave it to each person to take that idea and work it out in his or her own consciousness. And that is what I like about theosophy, that we have ideas like this. And then a time comes when we say, how can I know this and experience this for myself? And the beauty about the ideas of theosophy is that they can be experienced. We can take these ideas like some kind of hypothesis in science, a hypothesis that is workable, that we can experiment with, and put it to a test. And as we put it to a test in the life that we live, then the ideas now permeate our consciousness and we begin to experience it beyond words. This is the non-verbal learning. Right now we are going through a process of verbal learning. And then there is that non-verbal learning that does not come from anyone else except from the depths of our own consciousness. And that is what I like about this study of theosophy. But there is the freedom for every member of the society to make a belief on any idea that they want, so long as they do not impose this belief on another. And we might say this society is concerned with consciousness. We are concerned with consciousness because, you know, we live in a world and we would like to have a better world. And we would like to have peace. We'd like nations to get along with each other. But, and the way we do this, we set up governments, we set up systems, institutions, we set up laws and regulations, and we hope to bring a better world out of this. Some of us may even make demonstrations and articulate this as strongly as we like, because we would like to transform and have a better world. We would like to suggest that no real transformation can take place in the world unless first there is a transformation of consciousness. So finally, we can make many changes in the world, in the community, in the life around us. But if there is no transformation of consciousness, no real transformation has taken place. So let's use, we will use this as our closing now. Let's just use two examples. During the Stone Age, they used to kill by getting a stone and they hit another head with this. The larger the stone, the quicker the killing. Of course, they used clubs. Then later on, the killing was done by bow and arrows and by spears. What is the difference in the consciousness here and the consciousness in this 20th century of ours, where the killing is done by bombs, by missiles, by rocketry, dynamite. God forbid, the laser beam, they say it's going to hit us, and we won't know what zapped us the moment the laser beam is used. What is the difference in the consciousness? How far has the consciousness transformed itself? There must have been some transformation, but really, fundamentally, how far has the consciousness changed? The modes of killing may have been changed, but how far has consciousness changed? And here's another example. Supposing, let's say this is a backward economy. We have, let us say, a farmer to make extra money. He makes earthenware jars. And early in the morning, he gets up, he puts his earthenware jars in a cart, and it's pulled by a starving bull. You know, let's make it dramatic, you know. And the bull is pulling this cart, and he says, on the way now to the market, he says, if I arrive there early, then I can get a better price for my earthenware jars, because then I have less competition. I can get a good place where I can display my wares. Early in the morning, people will have more money. They have not bought other things. And then maybe I can make more with my earthenware jars. Now we are looking at the consciousness. What is the difference with this consciousness, with a 20th century consciousness of an executive riding a Mercedes-Benz on the New York Turnpike on the way to the New York Stock Exchange? And in his mind, he says, he's not carrying earthenware jars. He is a Samsonite briefcase, if you like. And inside this briefcase, he has stocks and bonds. And in his consciousness, he says, if I arrive there early, according to my home computer, I figured out this Dow Jones average, you know, if I arrive there on time, I can make a killing. What is the difference in the consciousness? And this is what we are saying. The final transformation, we are not against making a living, you know, or or maybe improving one's lot in life. We are not talking about this. We are talking about the consciousness. So finally, if there is any real change we would like to bring in the world, it must come in the realm of consciousness. Now, if this is so, who can transform and change consciousness? Can I transform yours? Can you transform mine? Can we transform each other's consciousness? Maybe we might help each other, maybe influence each other. But finally, we do our own transformation of our own consciousness. By the way, my friends, this is the meaning of the virgin birth. You know, when Christ was born, this refers to some kind of consciousness, a Christ-like consciousness of love and understanding and of peace. When it is born, nobody fathers this. Nobody outside of oneself fathers it. We ourselves father the birthing of this new consciousness within us. And therefore, when it is born, it is a virgin birth. Otherwise, if the virgin birth is taken literally, I call that the ultimate women's liberation. Because then the women can continue the propagation of the human race completely liberated from the male of the species. But we might say, maybe it is historically also true, but the real significance of this is probably the meaning behind this. That there is a Christ consciousness within us, a divine consciousness, the divine wisdom, the theosophy within us, but nobody can bring its birthing within us. Only we can bring it to birth within ourselves. And therefore, when it is born, it is a virgin birth. May it be that in the four meetings that we will have together, we shall come to a greater realization of this, not according to somebody else, but according to our own consciousness in the way that we see it. And the beauty about these ideas is that each of us can put this to a test and experience it for oneself, transcending thoughts, transcending theories, transcending concepts and ideas. But to know it as a process rather than some contents that are just perturbating in our minds and in our brains. May it be that you and I might come more and more into this. Only in this way, when we transform our consciousness, do we truly bring a transformation in the world. Human beings that have transformed their consciousness are the new human beings that will make a new humanity that finally transformed the world in itself. Because the condition of the world really is the condition of the human condition. But if we have human beings who have transformed their human condition in terms of a transformed consciousness, and we say this consciousness is of a spiritual nature, then such a consciousness transforms the world in itself. So one human being doing it, two, three, a group like this, more groups making a community, communities put together make a nation, nations put together make the world, beginning from the individual, then we transform the world. And this is our ultimate homework.